resume our meeting, and we are going to talk about post-implementation review of IFRS 8. April?
Okay, thank you. We finished the evidence gathering phase of the PIR in December, and we presented our preliminary findings to you in January. We've got four papers for you today. The purpose of the first three papers is to support you in the final phase of the PIR, which is your report and feedback statement. The contents of these papers, amended by your comments and decisions today, will form the basis of your report. Paper A discusses the sources of input to the PIR process and includes a due process protocol. B discusses the messages received and the feedback summary, and you'll recognize those messages, I hope, from the feedback that we gave you in January. And then Paper C summarizes the lessons that we've learned doing this PIR about the PIR process itself and how that might affect how we do any subsequent PIRs. Both Paper B and C also include a short comparison of our findings with those of the FAF's PIR. Now, after you've discussed these three papers, and in doing so indicated the content of your report and the feedback statement, that might be a good time for me to give you a brief update on the discussions that the FASB had yesterday on their response to the FAF PIR. And then the final paper today, which is Paper D, provides you with feedback from the April meeting of the Trustees Due Process Oversight Committee, where they reviewed an update of the PIR process. Each of the papers A to C asks you specific questions about whether you think the work in each is adequate and whether you have any comments or queries on its content. So if we could start firstly with paper 12A, which is sources of input to the PIR, the due process and next steps. In this, we discussed the sources of the input to the PIR, which was the public consultation through a request for information, outreach conducted, and the review of existing literature and academic researchers. And at the end of that, in page 7, we ask you a question whether you think that the review work afforded is adequate to ensure representative views have been obtained. Now, I know at this stage you haven't got the feedback itself, but this is just to say, do you think that you've had enough work done to actually be happy that you consulted adequately? Any comments or questions?
April, the one thing I guess I noted was that your outreach in the U.S. was relatively limited, right?
It was. We did ask, for example, people like the CFA Institute to take part, and they declined, right. I think partly because they'd already been consulted by the FASB.
I guess the reason I raise it is because, well, we all know that the U.S. doesn't allow the use of IFRS for domestic companies. The amount of analytical effort that's put into analyzing companies that report using IFRS, I would submit, is probably as great, if not greater, than anywhere else on the planet. And I think that it would be useful to gather, I'm not saying go back now, but go back, I should say, prospectively, in these matters, talk to sector analysts in the States, not just accounting analysts, but particularly sector analysts. That's where you're going to get the most valuable input. This is a very, very important issue when you look at financial statement content. Segment reporting is probably, you know, if not the highest item on somebody's list of important information, it's one of the top, probably, you know, three or four or five. So, I think the signals that you've gotten from CFA Institute, the analyst community in Europe, are probably going to be largely consistent, you know, with the messages you would have otherwise received, consistent at least with my understanding. But I would submit that that's a fertile marketplace that perhaps we're not digging into.
But the U.S. standard is the same as ours, and CFA has responded to the PIR from the FIF. So do you expect them to say something different to us?
I just said no.
I don't
expect them to.
But well, for us to know what they say.
No, we don't even officially know. They were asked.
Exactly.
We ask them to say, what do you tell the FIF? If you say something, if by chance Can you tell us what you say?
We do know, and as part of our academic review, we have reviewed the CFA Institute 2012 survey on this topic. So I think we do have a fair idea what the CFA Institute think.
This is an issue that was raised at the DPOC as well, and April put a special section in the report just analysing, I think, in a sense, the general messages from the US versus ours. They're roughly consistent as well.
Yeah.
But we also know for the next one, on IFRS 3, for example, business combinations, even though it's a converged standard, we should actually go and do some outreach directly with the US, and that's something we would do. It's an adjustment to our process for next time.
Agree. Okay.
Okay, continue, April.
So are we agreed that the work done has been adequate?
Yep.
Yes, we agree. Yes, we
agree. Question two, Appendix A, is a due process protocol on this topic. Have you got any questions on the due process protocol? And do you think that we have complied with the required due process?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Jan?
No, sorry.
Yes.
Okay, all agree?
That was the autopilot.
If we go to paper 12B then, this is the more detailed paper which deals with the messages received and the draft feedback summary. And it discusses messages in terms of the questions that were raised in the RFI, the basis of segmentation, measurement on an internal basis, the disclosure requirements, and also the practical issues that arose on implementation. So the first question for you on page 14 is, do you think we've identified all the key messages? And do you agree with the responses that we've noted in the feedback statement? And also, do you have any further comments on these topics?
The only comment I would have is if you could prioritize what you think are the most urgent to the least urgent, that would be helpful.
I disagree, because I think the PIR is just supposed to capture what the feedback is and not kind of do anything presumptive in terms of responses. I think we always were concerned about the PIR process kind of leading to an endless cycle of revision of the standards that are reviewed. So I think having captured, the comments and feedbacks and, feedback and maybe even indicating what the responses are, I think if we were to indicate kind of priorities, it just takes us to a presumption of action as opposed to saying, okay, this is information for our next agenda consult. So that was one. The other comment that I had in kind of relates to that, if you look at paragraph 43, it was funny because I looked at paragraph 43 and said, I don't feel that this is very helpful kind of headings, but then I found the text boxes in that, like, for example, paragraph 45, and the one or two lines at the beginning of each of the boxes to be the right kind of focus for what are the key areas we're covering. So I wouldn't spend my time in the summary trying to break them down as A through E unless there's a connection I'm missing, and maybe just use the captions that you've used in each of these tables. I had a few detailed comments on the details in a few of the items, but I'll pass those to you offline.
Anything else?
Yeah, I've got two.
Yep.
Page 11. And the investor's request for specific line items.
Yes.
So I agree with what they're saying. And you say in your response, this area warrants further investigation. The problem is that we've recently taken the decision to remove segment liabilities and segment assets as mandatory line items. So it seems a bit odd that we would consider, I'd love us to revisit that and add some more, but it seems a bit odd that we might consider going back on a very recent decision.
I think that recent decision was, you're right about the decision that was made, but it was also tidying up some inconsistency in the language.
Sure, so but it was tidying it up in a particular direction.
It was, and I think perhaps what this might prompt us to do is to think about, should we change direction?
Good. And then the following page, so adequacy of reconciliations. So the investors would like to have reconciliations by segment, so from the reported profit to the GAAP profit. So your response is no, by the look of it. So at the end you say, in our view, non-systematic allocation would reduce the value of segment reporting. Information reduced. I didn't understand that.
I don't think our conclusion is no necessarily. That's sort of the conclusion to the second part about understanding what the reconciling amounts reflect. Some investors and many others have said that one of the problems about requiring the reconciliation to be done by individual segment is that there will be a number of unallocated items which would have to be allocated on some sort of basis.
No, I don't think they would have to be. You don't.
Right.
You don't necessarily end up having to allocate central overheads, for example, by segment, just because you're reconciling to a GAAP measure. Reconciling to a GAAP measure means that if they've missed out share-based payments from the segment result, you put it back in. And if that particular reconciling item relates to something that hasn't been allocated, I don't see why suddenly you have to allocate just because you're now reconciling to a GAAP measure at the segment level.
Well, that was the point that the investors raised, that there were items in the reconciliation to GAAP which weren't allocated to segments.
Which would still have to
So that there
remain.
Would still be some which wouldn't be reconciled, but some that would be.
Yes, but it, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So I still think that's a valid request from the investors.
Just a small point here. The feedback statement, which I think is quite crucial to come out in this document, after this work, you're going to issue a feedback statement, if I remember correctly. Could you help me, maybe this is something we don't need to talk at length, but tying the feedback to the suggested improvements are suggested potential candidates for the future. Are we going to decide before the feedback statement comes what are the potential candidates for that, or how do we plan to do that?
I think perhaps the discussion will give some indication of what issues could be.
Does the board need to talk about those? I think if I look at your potential candidates for future, which is in the paragraph number, paragraph number 37.
Yep.
That is your candidate. Those are your candidates, right? So I'm just curious whether the board agrees with those six, or should we add some more? We don't need to do it at this board meeting. I'm just curious whether, is it a fait accompli that we are going to take these six things into the future, or is that a final list, things like that?
I think in the feedback statement, it would be clear that those were the items that looked as though they
are those the only items? Is there anything more, less than that? That's the question I have.
I think those are the only items, and I mean, for example, some of the very larger items that, say, the FASB might be considering aren't in here. Now, I don't know how we link up with the timing of what we think our potential narrow scope amendments would be if we were to take that into our June report, because I don't think at that stage the FASB would have considered what their potential amendments would be.
The reason I bring up is this, the CODM determination, which is your first item, because I remember this has been a persistent comment. I think that could go to the root of the standard, how the information subsequently gets displayed. And if we don't have synergy with the U.S. on that, we have a potential for divergence. In terms of reconciliation, which is your second point, I can see that, you know, yeah, we can put some examples to help people. I'm not too much fussed about it, but CODM can have a potential for divergence between both the standards. And how do we reconcile that? Because it's not just this issue, but it could be for tomorrow revenue and other joint standards. That's why I'm bringing it up. Think about that and see how we can fix it.
The short answer is there's no presumption that these are automatically going to be pushed through as items. I think as the lead says to this, these are the items that we think warrant further investigation, and that means including talking to the FASB about this, about whether we want to do something. And you know, to Mary's point, the idea of the post-implementation review, it's capturing those issues. And then we say, right, we've identified the narrow scope ones that we might want to think about doing something. It's almost like feeding those into the back to the Interpretations Committee or something to a narrow scope, and the other bigger ones would feed into the agenda consultation process, the three-year yearly process. We haven't got anything really for the three-yearly process, but we've got six items that we think, you know, we'll have a, let's have another look, talk to the FASB, try and work together with
them. Maybe you need to hum a few more bars to make sure that concept is clear. That's all I'm trying to say.
Let's clarify. Can we only make an agenda decision once every 3 years?
No. Just major. We can make them any. We have a major review every 3 years. But we've said publicly that if we had a very large, if this had come out and said, look, we think we might need to fundamentally rethink segment reporting, we shouldn't just automatically trigger off an agenda thing. We have to think about what our other priorities are. We've actually committed ourselves to a pretty full agenda. The idea would be that we would commit to considering that at the next three-year cycle. Now, if something really urgent came up, we'd have to think about acting more quickly. But the idea is if it's maintenance, we can just feed that in as time permits. Big things we should be a bit more cautious about.
One comment about the issue which was raised by some as a lack of consistency between management commentary and the reported segments. There are three possibilities for us. I think one is to ignore it and leave it to regulators to enforce more consistency, but they may not have a basis to do so based on the literature. Another way is to amend our standard on segments to include a requirement in it that management commentary should be aligned, but that would mean that we do create some requirements regarding management commentary throughout standard setting, which is probably not very practical. Is there another way to make a limited amendment to the management commentary best practice statement or practice statement and to make it recommendation in it that management commentary should stick or should be aligned to the way the segments are disclosed? A limited amendment to this improvement to this old management commentary thing?
Thank you. I had one comment that I wanted to make on aggregation, but you talked about the CODM a couple times. I'll just finish off that thought. I'm not sure why it's misunderstood. It's sort of an odd term, but ultimately it's inclined to be the top operating boss, you know, with the suggestion about perhaps redefining the key management personnel or something, I would be appreciating this may or may not ever get to be a project, would be very careful because key management personnel implies a group of people, and so roles and responsibilities change all the time, and how one level down in the company or even two levels down from the CEO are measured varies greatly, and it varies over time within a company. A lot of it's personality driven, their experience. So I'd just be careful about the redefining CDM to be a group of people. But the comment I really did want to make, it's on page 12 on aggregation criteria, similar economic characteristics is a vexing issue to preparers and certainly auditors, and I don't know about users or regulators, but and it cuts both ways. You know, you could have, they could be too similar, they could be too dissimilar. And, you know, the point where you could have something, or common economic characteristics is, or products use electricity. You know, that's probably not particularly useful, but it could be argued that way. Or all of our products are sold to retail markets as opposed to wholesale markets, or whatever. It's an issue. And if we're going to, reading of all the items that are in here that are being suggested, if I was going to pick one, having been in the trenches, this is the one I would pick to work on. I'm not suggesting which way you would go, but it cuts both ways. It you know, could be too tight or it could be too loose of a definition in practice. And I've talked to my colleagues. I know there's practices all over the place. This goes beyond just segment reporting because it gets into the impairment tests of goodwill and other items like that. Because you know, if the impairment at the reported segment are one level down, well, what's one level down? That's when the similar economic characteristics start coming into play. So.
We had this discussion too at the very end of our revenue recognition project, the tail end of our deliberations on disclosures, it might be useful to take a look at the board discussion on that. I think we came up with some pretty reasonable ideas.
Okay.
Can I go back and ask a question about the boundary of a post-issuance review? Because I did have some concerns looking at this paper about where in the boxes we were on page 12, so let's stay with that. We're a candidate, the second item, adequacy of reconciliations, potential candidate for consideration, scenario scope. Alan, you picked up on the comment before about feed it into the agenda decision, but then you said, but the, you know, repair and maintenance stuff we could feed into IFRIC. And I think we're already concerned about the volume of things. We don't want to be unhelpful, but it does lead me to question, what's the perimeter of a post-issuance review? Does it stop with reporting the findings and what it might take to address the findings? Do we automatically, you know, presume that we feed them, you know, take the next step of what could be done, and even for repair and maintenance, feed them into the interpretations committee and let them decide whether or not to put forward narrow scope amendments? I think we seem to be defining post-issuance review as following through to addressing at least those we can as repair and maintenance, as opposed to saying we've done the post-issuance review, were our objectives achieved, are there any significant problems identified, report the results, you know, and kind of and stop there. Not wanting to be unhelpful, but also not wanting to set up an expectation that we keep pushing it through the system. And while we could maybe do these as time allows, I'm not sure that 6 or 7 repair and maintenance projects at the Interpretations Committee on IFRS-8 are more important than some of the other things that they may be taking up, and they do, you know, consume bandwidth.
Yeah. We try to be very careful about this in rewriting the due process handbook, and I'll just read you the couple of sentences here. The ISB may consider making minor amendments to a standard, and it states clearly there is no presumption that a post-implementation review will lead to any changes to a standard.
Yeah.
Basically, it's up to us, in terms of maintenance, to prioritise, or else we may actually decide to prepare an agenda proposal for a broader revision of a standard. So we're very careful about making sure there's no presumption
right.
that stops when we do the report.
Right, but what PK was focused on before about the table following paragraph 37, I think it creates a presumption that at least these all are going to get fed into the Interpretations Committee.
Yeah, that was my question, exactly.
And does that go beyond what you just described, even though they're narrow scope as opposed to more fundamental consideration of, like, aggregation criteria?
I think the words there say we have identified some areas that we think warrant further investigation as potential subjects. So I think there's a lot of caution around that sentence.
And I think
when you're raising expectation.
I think one of the reasons why we included this, I think the report will say that there were no very significant things and we're not proposing that a fully comprehensive review of the standard would be necessary. I think one of the reasons why we did consider putting this in is simply so that this work isn't lost. And if in the future it does come that people are going to look at a proposal for this, they'll realize that there is a lot of input that we've received from outreach and from the request for information. And all of that information can be the starting point so that it isn't completely lost.
It was just the table following 37 that I was concerned about, not the more detailed one, not the individual subject ones.
Yeah, and I think these have been identified as areas for potential follow-up. Obviously, a decision needs to be made in terms of prioritization of resources as well, and do these represent more urgent, more higher priority things to look at versus the other things that are coming through? And also, we've got quite a lot coming through.
Perhaps the term potential follow-up would be a bit better. Potential narrow scope amendments, which indeed does create sort of an expectation while they're going to do something about it.
Yeah, okay.
Another point about bottom of page 10, the box, our suggested responses to the lack of definition of operating profit. I'm not sure that what we discussed so far on the conceptual framework really provides any response to the lack of a definition of operating profit. We were focusing on OCI and profit or loss, but within P&L, we are not discussing any of the line items or subtotals. So far, my understanding of what we're doing on the conceptual framework. So it's not a real appropriate response. That conceptual framework will deal with this matter of operating profit. But we should not create an expectation gap here.
John Wu?
Yes, thank you. Paragraph maybe 33. They are basically, it's standard adopted management perspective. So they are based on this feedback of post-implementation review. Is it positive? I mean, they're introducing more management perspective into other standards based on this analysis. Paragraph 33, you are saying investors, many of users, they think positive by introducing management perspective in this standard. It's much easier and the cost is very low. So based on this result, you may add, you know, this perspective into other standards, because there was a big issue when he made this standard in the U.S. and also in the in maybe in the ISB. So whether this is quite desirable to include management perspective, that's a big issue. So I confirm whether that's a good idea or not.
I mean, paragraph 33 says that from management's perspective, it's made their communication with their investors easier. Whether or not investors appreciate the management perspective, there are different views on that. It's hard to see in some respects what other areas of financial reporting would be so open to a management perspective point of view. I mean, the segment gets to the heart of how you manage a business, but it's difficult to think of what other elements in the financial statements are looked at in two different ways, either in a management perspective or in a financial perspective. I mean, I can't think offhand of a management perspective for something like borrowings or disclosures of many, many issues.
Thank you. But April, I'm not suggesting, I'm not asking you to identify some other areas to apply this management perspective, but I'm just thinking, because of the introduction of this perspective is quite, you know, debated, you know, among many constituents, so that's why I'm thinking, you know, maybe if there is a chance, maybe this is a quite positive result we have, then we can think about the possible potential areas to put this perspective more, you know. So that's why if the result is not so positive, then we have to stop to introducing this perspective into other standards or other disclosures. So that's why I'm asking, you know. So they are based on your maybe personal observation rather than the documented one. Maybe do you think you are quite happy with this introduction of managed perspective?
I think it's worked well for a number of people for IFRS 8, perhaps against original expectations.
Any other comments? No?
Okay, the final question in that paper, we included as an appendix the extract from the FAS press release of their post-implementation review. And we do ask if there are anything in that findings that you think contradict our findings or otherwise give you cause for concern. I do realize it is a very high-level review, the FAF reserve. In the staff view, there wasn't anything in the comments that they did make publicly that we thought were substantially different from our findings. Right. If we could turn to paper 12C, which deals with the lessons that we learned about the PIR process itself. A number of people, when they replied to the request for information and also when we've been performing outreach with people, they did give us quite a few comments about the process itself. And I think generally people were very pleased that we did the PIR. I think they thought that when we took on the various comments that we received at the planning stage and the trustees changed the approach in April, people thought that was well received. And so we've in this paper we've noted some of the messages that we've received, and we've tried to split them between messages that would be relevant to any PIR, messages that were probably just relevant to IFRS 8, so that we don't lose this information and that the work that we've done here will inform the operation of the subsequent PIRs. So do you think that we identify the key messages about the process itself? Do you agree with the conclusions that we've drawn about which are transferable and which aren't? And do you have any further comments yourself about the process?
Amaro? I have comments on in two items. One is timing. So for this particular assessment, you affirmed that 2 years worked well in the post implementation. So this here we don't bring any comments received, because at least the meetings I participated in some aspect, many people started their comments on, well, 2 years is not really the appropriate time. And so here is our perception, and I think these people that almost all that I talked about, this post-implementation review, they started with this caveat, well, 2 years is not enough, but I'll do my best. I think we should capture this a little bit more here, because it's too blank or it's too binary here. So it's our perception, but we do not bring theirs. Although you, in paragraph 44, you make some, you bring to our attention that aspects such as type of transaction, endorsement, concerns should be taken into consideration in the future. But I think this, at least for me, was a quite strong message that 2 years was not enough. And I the way it is written here doesn't capture this in my mind. And the second point is the management of expectations. I think you are right here. And maybe a way to manage these expectations, I guess, Alan's just... Well, in the previous discussion, we talked about of expectations. So it's clearly one aspect that we should be very clear about what the post-implementation review is and manage this. So in the final report, I think it would be worthwhile to keep stressing what is the purpose and what is the potential outcome in order to have the expectation management managed in the right level.
Well, one problem with that, Amara, is it depends a bit, and we had this discussion at the beginning of this. So if you really did find that the thing was broken, that everybody hated it, then that might lead to one conclusion, you know. So we can't rule out the possibility. Am I out of order?
No.
They've just assumed you're going to do something silly. So.
Can't rule out the possibility that there might be actions as a result. But I mean, I can take your point, and I think it's quite well written.
Yeah. No, it's just reinforcing the importance of expectations in this process. Tak?
Yes, thank you. Almost same point with Amaro about timing. In your paragraph 43, you said, this is well accepted. But I think the reason why it was successful is largely because we had a U.S. gap. And if you look at paragraph 54, it says, in the case of U.S. gap, it's 50 years after the first implementation. So I think for the post-implementation review, length of the time is very important. And in the first couple of years, it is quite difficult to understand the benefit of the new standard. If I look back my experience of the US GAAP, when I first applied management approach, it was quite difficult for us to understand what it's all about. But after time goes by, and after having a good dialogue with investors and analysts, then we have improved it well. And now it's now fitting in. So one thing we have to be careful when we talk about the timing, we have to know that in the first couple of years, problems will come about. And then the benefit will be realized later. But having said that, it depends on the nature of the standards and the problem. So in order to decide what is the best timing, I think the assessment of the problem, assessment of the nature of the standard is quite important. So in this sense, I think we have to have a close communication with the IFRIC team and analyze what's the current issues. We have to be flexible for the timing of post-implementation review.
And Tak, if I can, if I can just sort of comment on that. I mean, as we set out in the papers, the post-implementation review has two phases. And the first one is the preliminary information gathering phase.
Right.
To then sort of develop the request for information for phase two, which is the main information input. And at the end of that phase one, we would expect that the board would then make a decision, make an assessment on that preliminary information to determine whether it's right to go ahead at that time or whether that's too early and perhaps we should wait and go further on. So that's one of the ways in which we're building in, or will be building into the future PIR's responses to that sort of concern.
Oh, thank you.
Any other comments? No?
The final question in that paper relates to the from paragraph 51 onwards, where we just note what the effect of reviewing a converged standard would be in the PIR process. And just at the top level, we ask, do you agree that the development of changes to a converged standard proposed as a result of a PIR should include active liaison with the FASB?
Okay, disagrees.
No. Oh. Why do you think that? Well, don't presuppose. You know, when Tak said, as time goes by, I just remembered Casablanca song. So you're very... I felt like a kiss is a kiss. So... anyway, coming to the question that you asked, I think the PIR, I agree with your suggestion. I feel that, and some of us in the room agree with me, is that a PIR is not just post-implementation review, it should be post-issuance review. So for the active liaison with FASB, I think some thoughts have been developed to understand how do we develop the liaison with FASB to make sure that, especially in revenue and leases, we continue to join. So I think it is going to be, my suggestion should be wrapped in the same logic.
Okay, well, okay. It's about developing guidance, any form of guidance at the time and post-issuance. It's not the review of the implementation, which comes later, which much sooner.
I'm just saying that we need to do it from the post-issuance,
okay.
Not just post-implementation, yes. And I think it should be wrapped into that so that we do in a much more concerted way as opposed to just a post-implementation review.
Right.
So especially with the revenue and leases, we need to think through. Because FASB is planning to start something just revenue on the implementation issues.
Should this
issuance reviews.
ASEF and not just FASB?
Yeah.
But we would with ASEF. I mean, I think the point here is if we've done a converged standard, if we want to remain converged,
let's
then
keep
we'll,
in close
we'll need to
yeah.
work together.
Yeah.
We go.
2 points. First one, 3 years were too short, you know. This time we only one standards. You know. Several years later, you know, think about we have, you know, consolidation package, 3, 4, 5 standards, and the 13, and maybe some others. Involve lots of efforts. And as Taka said, you know, time is too short.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, Alan, in among the trustees and the due process oversight committee, whether there are any discussions about the frequency of the review. I do feel 3 years is too short. And secondly, I'm not sure, PK, what you suggest. You, my guess is, you know, after we issue standards, you know, companies, big four firms may find lots of implementation issues technically, some errors and some unclear the point, and then we need some kind of interpretation and others. I feel it is all, it is a dilemma for us, you know. If you notice the recent issues in front of APEC, you know, maybe, Michael, I'm not sure I'm right or not, maybe at least one third are issues related to the standards either have not implemented or start to implement but shortly after starting implementation. There are lots of questions come out. And for example, business combinations and others. The question to us is, you know, whether we should, you know, amend so frequently or provide guidance so frequently before the standard had not been implemented or right after, shortly after the implemented standards. I'm not sure on this, you know, PK, frankly.
I haven't got the statistics. Certainly, new standards do naturally create questions for us, but it's obviously something that we'd think carefully about in terms of whether it's appropriate to make amendments to standards so newly issued. In fact, it may be a case of helping people get to grips with the new requirements rather than there being something that needs to be fixed in the standards. So the fact that we may have a number of questions doesn't necessarily mean that it's an issue with the standard, but just getting to grips with its new requirements.
My example is, I think when IFRS 3 business combinations was issued, we had a staff member who was receiving requests for absolutely necessary changes so they could implement it. We had 72 such requests, which I think we ended up having 5 narrow scope suggestions and finalised either 2 or 3. So, you know, I think we have a pretty... It's always tricky getting the right balance in there, you know, and sometimes we might overreact by trying to change words. But we've got some good examples where I think we've probably reacted in a responsible way. So I think we've got a good functioning interpretations process that we just have to continually monitor, make sure that we're not being unresponsive or overly responsive.
About the frequency of post-implementation review, whether 3 years, too short of...
Well, the due process handbook, again, I was saying to Ian, I said it's very well written, I think, because it actually says, essentially, after about 3 years of implementation, actually go and have a look. And it says, on the basis of your initial assessment, that's our talking to the people, it may be premature to undertake a review at that time. If that's the case, you tell the DPOC and you say, we should wait 2 years. So all we're saying is, what we don't have discretion about is sitting there saying, oh, we think that one we can wait for 10 years, for example. We have to go in after about 2 to 3 years and just have a look, and then we can either pull back if we like. So I think we've got a lot of flexibility in here, but we have to just make informed decisions about timing and transparent decisions.
We always said this one was going to be a lot of suck and see, you know, to find out how it went and work out how we go in the future. Any more comments?
April, when are you going to tell us about yesterday's discussion at the FASB?
Right now. the FASB discussed their response to the FAF's post-implementation review yesterday. And that discussion was public, although the papers were not. So it was a slightly difficult discussion to follow because you didn't know what paragraph 83 said or what have you. But the papers discussed the FASB's response to the PAR. It focused on an appendix to the paper that tabled areas for possible amendment, along with the staff conclusion or recommendation about whether or not it should be pursued. The tone of the discussion was that the amendments would be in the nature of narrow scope amendments rather than a comprehensive review of the standard, and the management perspective would be retained. And like us, any proposed amendments to segment reporting would be assessed alongside all the other topics for priority assessment. The FASB plans in the first instance to consult with FASAC. There will be a survey issued to FASAC members. It wasn't clear yesterday whether it was too late for this topic to be included in that survey. But after consulting with FASAC, they have also suggested consulting with their investors forum, the ITAC, and the staff also noted that they may need to conduct limited outreach to supplement and confirm the findings that the FAF reported in their post-implementation review. The FASB throughout this process have had access to all of our papers, and the FASB are aware of the need for us to coordinate our work if we're to remain converged. The details of how that can be done can't be worked out at this stage because it will depend very largely on whether we identify the same issues and whether we ascribe the same priorities to them. The FASB staff did note in the discussions that our two constituents and the two boards may have very different appetites for change. For example, the question about aggregation. The FASB constituents are very keen to have examples and more detailed guidance and thresholds about how that would work, whereas our constituents would have said that they'd like to get rid of thresholds and they would prefer to stick to principles. So we may find that although we've got similar issues, we may feel that we want to address them in different ways. The FASB staff are preparing a prioritization schedule for the FASB, and that will include input from individual board members about the priorities ascribed to the issues that were identified yesterday in the papers. And once they establish the priorities, then the FASB would be in position to talk to us. Now, we'll continue to liaise at a staff level about that to sort of make sure that we don't lose sight of each other on that one.
So what were the issues?
We don't know.
So it was a public meeting and we don't know what they talked about?
Apparently they don't publish their papers now, automatically.
The FASB doesn't publish their papers, their board papers.
I mean, we do know from talking to staff, obviously, a number of the issues, and as we've been preparing our papers on our findings, they've been going through them to see if there's anything that contradicts with their findings.
So we do know what the issues are?
We have a fair idea what the issues are, but they don't line up very well because we haven't had a chance to discuss them with them. And because they've got so little detail on the issues, they don't line up. We do know that there are a number of issues that they've taken onto their analysis which only arise out of our working papers and out of our agenda papers because we have got much more detail. So, for example, the request that investors have made that instead of just having 1 year's comparative on restatement, we have 3 or 5 years comparative, that only comes out of our workings and our findings. We will be liaising with the staff in the future on the detail of what is in their findings so that we can work out how we get a plan.
Should we be liaising with the FASB staff or FAF staff? No, I'm confused because
it's the FASB.
Both are doing the work.
The FAF did the original post-implementation review, and based on that, the FASB went back to see what effect this should have on standard setting and also what effect it should have in relation to the individual standard. And it is now the FASB staff who are investigating the findings to see what should be done.
Having a second go at the same
time. Yeah.
I thought FASB board papers were available hard copy if you attended the meeting.
well, A, I didn't attend the meeting, but B, I'm not sure they were available, because certainly I did request the papers before the meeting and I was told they were confidential.
It may be because they were PIR papers.
I think, I know when we work on joint projects, their papers are always publicly available because our papers are always publicly available.
Which must make it pretty difficult for people to follow their meetings.
It always has.
Right. So anyway, we will be liaising with the staff in on the detail to see what lines up and where we have common areas. The final paper is paper 12D, where we just note some quick feedback from the DPOC who met in April, earlier in April. The DPOC concluded that we'd consulted adequately and engaged at an appropriate level, that the agenda papers that you've seen at this meeting adequately describes the PIR process and the future steps. And in their view, you had complied with the due process steps required to report on the PIR. Yep. Do you have any questions on that meeting?
Questions?
Thank you, April.